Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Tuesday, March 13th, 2018. The time is 9:03 a.m. If you're joining us off net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, the state capitol, fifth floor, in Senate Finance. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki is in another committee presenting a bill. He should join us shortly. Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, good morning.
Good morning. Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? On today's agenda, we have two items, SB 108, Medical Care Licensing with the Medical Board, and PCE and Community Assistance. The first item before us is SB 108. A brief history on this. We heard the bill on 2/27/2018. The public hearing was opened and closed. We reviewed the fiscal notes and had one outstanding issue. We have a CS to address that issue. No amendments were received. If I could invite Julie Lucky to the microphone. Senator Bishop, may I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 108, version 30-LS0740/Tango, before the committee as our working document.
I'll object for purposes of introduction of the new CS. Ms. Lucky, if you could place your name on the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Julie Lucky. I'm staff to Senator McKinnon. As the committee may recall, during the previous hearing on Senate Bill 108, there was an issue regarding a possible trademark infringement of the term using the title Certified Medical Assistant or the initials CMA. After working with the sponsor and our legal team, we have the CS in front of you, which has changes to both take care of that issue and also make a clarification. Your office should have received yesterday the CS and an explanation of changes, which I'll be using for the presentation. The changes are on page 3, lines 26 through 27. There is a clause added that reads, the board may recognize national certification by an approved entity to satisfy some or all of the qualifications for state certification. As the program that was having difficulty with the trademark title is a national certification program that already exists, this gives the board flexibility to look at that training and their certification and decide whether or not that would satisfy the requirements for state certification. On page 4, lines 13 through 15, this is section 5 of the bill, and subsection A has been reworded to remove the terms certified medical assistant and CMA, and now the section reads, a person may not represent that the person is certified as a medical assistant when providing patient care unless the person is certified as a medical assistant under this chapter. On page 6, lines 11 through 14, there was inclusion of some language just to clarify access to the PDMP, that a certification would also be a license, as that is the specific term that is required to access the PDMP, is that a person is licensed in the state. So this is more of a belt and suspenders to ensure that we don't run into a little bit of a problem, because certification is used in one term where licensure is used in another part of the statute. While we were drafting this section, it was noticed that the term certified medical assistant still appeared in this one section of the bill. Therefore, the amendment that will be before you later on, which is amendment number 1, rewords that section to say medical assistant certified, so that we are sure that we are not accidentally using that term anywhere in the bill. There were some other technical and conforming changes which are listed in your summary of changes. I'm happy to go through those, but they were basically section number changes and then some other rewording to remove the term certified medical assistant.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
And Madam Chair, thank you. We heard in testimony that one of the problems was an enormous backlog of 290 applicants, which I have down. How can we be assured that this will clear that up and have a faster approval of the licensure?
Senator Stevens, Madam Chairman, this was not an issue that was addressed in the CS, but I'm sure that Senator Diesel or
Thank you, Ms. Lucky. Senator Stevens, we're in the process of adopting a CS. If we could get the CS before us, then we could ask the sponsor that question.
Okay, if you'd remember that.
Is there objection to the CS? Seeing and hearing none, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection to adopting version T? Seeing and hearing none, version T is before us. Senator Stevens.
So the prior question, Senator Giesel, could you help us understand how this will clarify the or improve the 290 applicants that we've seen in the past, the backlog?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, nothing can guarantee that a backlog will be completely alleviated, but this bill will make significant strides forward by allowing those clean, air quotes, clean applications to be routinely approved by the executive secretary.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I assume, Senator Giesel, this is something you'll pay attention to.
Senator Stevens, through the chair, absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Senator Olson, followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Giesel, are you in favor of the new CS?
Senator Olson, through the chair, yes. The changes are very acceptable.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just along the lines of Senator Stevens' comments, I mean, I'm sure Senator Giesel, we're going to add two more positions to this as well. It's in the fiscal note, you know, and I would hope that adding two more people to the process will expedite the licensing requirements. You know, one hospital in particular in my one of my communities is has expressed the a little bit of a frustration in the backlog because they spend up to $250,000 a year doing the research and the due diligence and because we have been a backlog, that doctor will then go find a job somewhere else. And I'm hoping that these two full-time positions will help alleviate that because that's money that's out the door, gone, and wasted. So hopefully this bill will do what it's supposed to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. And we did review the fiscal note some time ago, so for the general public who might be watching, this is a receipt service function that is bringing two folks on to help manage the medical community for us through their own receipts. Senator Bishop, could I have a motion on amendment number one?
Madam Chair, I move amendment number one.
I'll object. Just re-clarifying that deleted the words on page 6, line 14, certified medical assistants, and inserted medical assistant certified for clarity. I'll remove my objections. Is there any further objections to adoption of amendment 1? Seeing none, amendment number 1 is adopted. Senator Giesel, it's the intent of the committee to try to move the bill out today. Any closing comments prior to that vote?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop, may I have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 108, version 30-LS0740/Tango, as amended from committee with the accompanying fiscal note and committee recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, the CS for the sponsor substitute for Senate Bill number 108, Finance/T, moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Welcome back to Senate Finance. The next item on this agenda is community assistance and power cost equalization. I'd like to invite David Teal to the microphone. I'd also like to welcome former Representative Bill Thomas, as well as the former Speaker of the House, John Harris. And we actually even have a former Commissioner of Labor in our audience, Diane Bloomer. There are others that I may not know as well, so thank you all for joining us here today. Mr. Teal, if you could introduce yourself and please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. And you asked me to give a brief history of both community assistance and power cost equalization programs. I think the emphasis being on how they're funded and how they're linked together. So starting with community assistance, the state's offered various financial assistance programs to communities since 1969, some dependent on services, everything from do you have a fire department to how many miles of road do you maintain in the community, various tests of local services provided. Some were based on the amount of state revenue, some were based on population, some based on multiple of those. So the programs have changed quite a bit over time. 20 years or so, the first 20 years really, were a combination of the Safe Communities program and state revenue sharing, and you can see that in this graph. They were operating simultaneously, Safe Communities providing close to $20 million a year and revenue sharing about $10 million a year. Now, backing up, these payments are rather low. In the 1980s, payments reached in excess of $140 million to communities. And, of course, recall that the budget at that time was half of what it is now, so the a much larger proportion went to communities. But over time, in the 90s, the payments declined to reach about $30 million, and that's where this graph picks up at about $30 million in FY 2000.
So, Teal, when those payments were declining, were the state starting to pick up costs inside of local communities through other ways? As an example, in the Anchorage area, was more money going to human services in the Anchorage area as well as support for local public safety versus a drop-off but actually a cost shift into other areas that were more specific?
Madam Chair, that was occurring at the same time revenue was declining. So you have two impacts which reduce the payout.
Thank you.
Now, both programs, Safe Communities and State Revenue Sharing, terminated in 2003, and we had 5 years here of, I guess you could call them energy assistance programs. The first year in 2004 was temporary fiscal relief. It was actually federal funds that were used. And then small amounts of energy assistance growing to a much larger amount of what they call municipal community energy assistance. During these energy assistance years, there was a long-running debate. One side argued that revenue sharing means no state revenue, then no money to distribute. And they favored ad hoc payments that were dependent on the financial condition of the state. So it was a year-by-year decision as to whether or how much funding should go to communities. On the other side were those that said communities need money they can count on well in advance of actually receiving it, and that the ad hoc method of funding simply didn't give them the time to plan for their own local budgets. So there was a push to have some sort of long-term funding in place, predictable funding. And beginning in 2009, there was a compromise. that the legislature created a fund, the Community Assistance Fund. Deposits to the fund depend on revenue. So it has revenue sharing elements to the compromise. But distributions to the communities didn't depend on revenue in the current year. They depended on the balance in the fund, which meant that communities had a reduced payout if revenue in several prior years had been low and deposits had been low, but that there was a known amount that they would be getting and a three-year phase out of payments to communities. There were a few extra payments under that program. I guess I should say there was a $60 million target, which occurred for a number of years. And then you may recall that 2012 and 13 were years of high state revenue, and there was extra money added to the payouts. It wasn't through the fund. It was on top of fund distributions. And those went away. As the money declined, and now you can see that the $60 million is fading. It's really easier to see what happened on this chart. It shows how the Community Assistance Fund works. The starting balance is $180 million, and that was just a deposit to get us there. The idea being that in each year you distribute one-third of the balance. So there was a $60 million distribution, and then you deposited $60 million, getting you back to your starting point of $180 million, which then the following year resulted in another $60 million distribution. It would have gone on like that forever had deposits continued to go in at the rate of $60 million per year. But oil prices crashed. And in FY15, the legislature did not deposit $60 million. They deposited $52 million, bringing the balance to $172 million and the distribution, one-third of that, to $157.3 million. No money in 16 meant no deposit to the fund. The fund balance fell to $114 million, and the distribution then fell to $38 million. But communities knew this a year in advance of actually getting the distributions. Then in 16, SB 196 passed, and it provided an alternative source of funding, because I think legislators could look into the future a bit and say, general funds are not a reliable source of funding when we're saying it's a revenue-sharing element to this program. And so changed the name to Community Assistance in recognition that the funding no longer depended on the amount of state revenue available and that it was simply a program providing assistance to communities. They also had an alternative source of funding for the program, and that was earnings of the PCE endowment, Power Cost Equalization Endowment, which is the other part of this presentation. And it's probably best to just turn to PCE at this point. It may seem odd that community assistance and power cost equalization are related, but because one is a program that provides financial assistance to communities, and the other provides direct subsidies to individuals to help them cover electrical power costs. So here, just starting with power cost equalization, that program was established in 1985. You may recall that during the late 70s and early 80s, there were large state expenditures on energy projects, particularly hydro projects, and that those hydro projects generally benefit urban areas. Well, no surprise, a number of urban legislators say, great program, we support the hydro projects, but not, I guess one way to put it is, but what's in it for rural areas? We don't benefit from the hydro projects. How do we get our share of all the money that's been put into subsidized power costs for urban areas? So the PCE program did that. Now, it's hard to have large hydro projects or projects of any kind that help small urban areas. They were at the time and still are dependent upon diesel generation to a large extent, and that's expensive. So the PCE program took the average rates paid by residents in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, and the difference between the local community rates, subsidized a portion of that, and I think importantly, limited the usage to about 500 kilowatts, which isn't much. For those of us in the urban centers, that's equivalent to about a $50 electric bill. So it's not like go ahead and leave the lights on all night kind of program. It's a minimal coverage of a subsidy of power costs. And that's directly to the electric utilities, which then reduce the rates for individuals. Until 2001, it was funded through annual appropriations of general funds. There was a long period when the funding was capped at $15.7 million annually, despite higher program costs than that. The program was prorated during those years. And then in 2001, $100 million from the sale of the Four Dam Pool and from the Constitutional Budget Reserve was appropriated to the PCE Endowment Fund. Another $182 million was added in 2007, another $400 million added in 2012. That $400 million was actually sufficient to fully fund the PCE program. But because there's the three-year or four-year look back on the balance, the $400 million did not begin to fully fund the program until that three-year phase-in period or look-back period was fully implemented. So that brings you up to about 2014-15 was the first year that the GF subsidy to cover program costs was eliminated. Then, as you can see, the balance at that time, balance of the endowment was approaching $1 billion. And in 2016, legislation was passed. Again, mentioned it for community assistance. It was SB 196. And it allowed PCE earnings from the endowment to be used for other purposes, specifically including community assistance in rural energy programs. The rule was, if earnings in the second prior year exceed program costs, and it's earnings of the endowment, exceed program costs, then 70% of those excess earnings are available first to the community assistance program, up to $30 million. When that bucket is filled, you can then fund up to $25 million of rural energy programs. Anything left after that remains in the endowment. So the program started in FY 17, and if you look back to the second prior year earnings, $33 million in earnings to pay $40 million in program costs left you with no money to go to the community assistance or energy programs. Similarly, in FY18, earnings were $8.9 million in FY16, which were less than the program cost, and again, there was no money to distribute. But then we get to FY19, in which case we're looking at earnings on the endowment in 2017, and those earnings were $112 million. Program costs were $33.1 million. So there's two things happening here, a huge increase in earnings and a decrease in program costs from what had been the low $40 million range to now $33 million. So that $112 million in earnings left $79 million excess after paying for the cost of the PCE program. 70% of that is $55 million, which was distributed first to the community assistance program, the $30 million, and then another $25 million for rural energy, leaving 24.2 in the fund and bringing the balance up to over $1 billion. In the future, a 6% earnings rate will allow some money, but not the full $30 million to go to community assistance. And just looking ahead, if we were to earn 6% annually, the amount of money going to community assistance would be roughly $20 million a year, leaving the legislature to find an alternative source for that missing $10 million. Presumably that would be general funds. But going to the spreadsheet where I can change the earnings, if that earnings were to change to 7%, that would be sufficient to allow money to be deposited to the community assistance program. It would take 4 or 5 years before the $30 million bucket is filled and the overflow would go into the rural energy programs. And of course, we don't know what the earnings are going to be, so it's hard to say that exactly what you're facing. But based on projected earnings of the permanent fund, I think it's likely that community assistance will not be fully funded from the PCE program for a number of years. Again, earnings are volatile. It might be that there are some years when community assistance is fully funded, but that doesn't look like it's going to happen for a number of years.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Teal, as I'm looking down the ending balance sheet on the right-hand side, it's pretty consistent as it's marching up the way, but why in 17 does it take such a spike?
Through the chair.
Because if you look at the year before, you've lost, it looks like you've lost $20 million.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, you've got earnings here that are variable.
Sure.
And you can see that in some years the fund has lost money, some years it's made a lot of money. Here in 15, 3% earnings, then 1%. In 17, the earnings jumped to 12%, $112 million. So it really depends on earnings. Again, some years the earnings are insufficient to fund the PCE program alone, let alone have enough earnings to spill over and help fund community assistance. Some years there would be a great deal of excess earnings which would fund, after funding PCE, there would be sufficient money left to fully fund community assistance, as happened in 19.
Thank you, Mr. Teal. Would like to recognize Senator Hoffman. The Finance Committee advanced these two ideas and dovetailed them together. One, to change the expectation from some communities that we had revenue to share, that it was assistance and that we were trying to assist during this difficult time, but we had to reduce that assistance but try to create some stability. And so Senate Finance produced two bills, one of which I carried on behalf of the committee and one that Senator Hoffman carried. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to thank you for the guidance on Senate Bill 196. I think it recognized the state of Alaska's financial problems. It reduced the revenue sharing program down to $30 million and renamed it the Community Assistance Program. And it also looked at how the excess earnings of the power cost equalization would be spent. And I think it's early in its infancy, this new program, but I think it does provide a mechanism where the excess earnings can be utilized for the additional programs. But there has been some discussion, Mr. Teal, about whether or not the fund, the power cost equalization endowment fund, is actually overcapitalized, and I wonder if you could speak to that issue.
Mr. Teal.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I guess first you have to define overcapitalized, and I would define that as spinning off more earnings than are necessary to support the programs that are supposed to be supported. Even if we look at a 7% return in the future, which I think is a high return on average, community assistance wouldn't be fully funded until 2024, according to this, but out there 5, 6, 7 years. And after paying for PCE costs and then paying for community assistance costs, the endowment is supposed to be spinning off enough to dump $25 million towards rural energy programs. And through 27, we're still a long ways from reaching that. So based on these numbers, I'd say there's no concern about overcapitalization through probably the 2030s. And of course, that just means there's $30 million and $25 million for the two spillover programs, community assistance and rural energy. And by that time, inflation is going to mean that your $30 million and $25 million don't have anywhere near the value that they have now. So the short answer is, it doesn't appear to me that the program is overcapitalized.
Follow-up, Senator Hoffman.
No. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Teal, you have pointed out that the earnings rate is significantly variable, and then therefore the payout to the communities is variable. Is there a recommendation to maybe smooth out the payments, help manage expectations to make them more predictable? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Mr. Teal.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the payouts to communities can be very stable. All that means is that you'd be going to this type of payout where one-third of the balance, and this still holds, one-third of the balance is paid out. And as long as the $30 million deposit is equal to the $30 million payout, then community assistance is extremely stable. It's a constant $30 million. The problem is that the PCE endowment isn't guaranteed to spin off enough money to fill that $30 million bucket. If that happens, then the stability can be maintained only by making up the difference with general funds or some other source of money. But if you don't allocate any more money, then you can see what happens. Zero deposit means a lower fund balance, a lower payout. But communities will have a 3-year phase out and will know that the distribution will be falling, and they will know it a year in advance so that they can plan their local budgets. And I'm not suggesting that you let this community assistance program live or die by the PCE earnings. I think if you do that, then community assistance payments are likely to be volatile, unless the endowment is larger than it is. But that it's going to be up to the legislature to deposit money into the community assistance program in years in which earnings are insufficient.
Madam Chair. Senator Von Imhoff.
So, Mr. Teel, wouldn't you agree, though, that even with a larger endowment, payments can still be volatile because the market is volatile? I guess what I was just hoping is that if we could manage this fund a slightly different way or manage the payout a slightly different way, we could make it more stable. I think that communities really account on this money, and when years that they don't have it at all, I think it's very difficult. And as we're talking about percent of market value in other avenues, i.e. with the Mental Health Trust Fund, among others, with a $1 billion fund, that's a pretty darn big fund that could, over time, provide a consistent revenue source for communities.
Thank you, Senator Von Imhoff. If we could isolate the two issues, we have power cost equalization that has underwent multiple changes over the last 5 years. One of the first changes that I don't recall being pointed out by Mr. Teel is that Senator Hoffman brought forward a piece of legislation to reduce risk of the fund, of the PCE fund management. And I can't recall the exact percentages, but we went from a more aggressive stance on the fund, a higher risk investment, to a more medium risk investment. Senator Hoffman, do you recall the exact percentages? But I know that we dropped down into the 6% range, I believe, for an estimated rate of return instead of pushing above 7%.
So I think it was 7.5%.
That it was 7.5%, and then we moved it down into the
right.
6.75. I don't recall.
So the funds weren't pushed up to investments that were more risky to try to achieve the higher rate of return, which would have made it more volatile. So the concept was to invest in less risky investments to provide a lower rate of return.
Thank you. So the first 15 years while we were depositing into the fund and growing the fund, the fund's financial advisors were deploying those resources into investment portfolios that had higher rates of return and with that also had greater risk. So this committee had before it within the last 4 years a bill that reduced the interest rate statutorily, the goal that the fund managers would go after. So that was the first change to lower risk and stabilize earnings at a lower rate of return. And then came the conversation and the shortfall of revenue coming into the state of Alaska and the recognition by Senate Finance and many of the people that are sitting at this table today that we could no longer afford to bank in. Mr. Teel, if you would put back up your slide that showed the slide three, that showed a program that was established at $180 million statutorily and then with a three-year lever so that communities could see, again, speaking to Senator Von Imhoff's concern for local communities that they were counting on that. And so there is that three-year look back where as long as she recharged the fund, communities could look at community revenue sharing at $150 price per barrel of oil at that particular time, if folks remember, or high oil prices during those times, and we could spin off a shared portion of $60 million for a couple years. And then, of course, the market began to fall, and this finance team came together and tried to look for ways to reduce total spend but still create stability, and that's when we established the $90 million cap that you see reflected in FY18, rolling off that $30 million per year. And so I'll just say for myself that I did not expect it to fully fund as quickly as it did, that we would see that in this year, that power cost equalization's earning has actually stepped in and created $30 million of additional receipt authority to share with communities and been able to roll into the second bucket, or the third bucket, I should say, that was created to provide assistance to AEA on energy projects in rural Alaska. And that is not going to be a continuous pattern, so we want the people of Alaska to recognize that. There was high earnings in FY17, 12%, and certainly we're going after a higher rate of return than 6% right now, but that is what has provided us this opportunity in this particular year to have those two items funded. Senator Hoffman, anything else on clarity for that? Because I want to move into power cost equalization.
I think you described it perfectly, Madam Chair.
And so this Senate Finance Committee should recognize that in future years, community assistance will require a general fund appropriation to keep that balance whole, or as described by Mr. Teal, that there will be a slow downturn and communities would have 3 years charged in the fund as we draw those down for individual communities. But moving back now to slide five, and I'm looking at the program costs, Mr. Teal, and they're fixed after 19 at 33.1, which is lower than program costs from FY18. So to me, that looks like a plugged-in number that is good for accounting purposes to view what is happening, but may be unrealistic. So my question is the power cost equalization program based on kilowatt hours used plus administrative expenses, or is it based on a fixed dollar fee that this might suggest going out past FY19?
Madam Chair, 19 estimated costs are 33.1. We simply left it at 19 costs. In the future, costs will be determined primarily by the price of fuel in the villages, because that determines the price of electricity. Juneau and Anchorage have fairly fixed prices of fuel. Fairbanks is more reliant on fossil fuels, and their price is a little higher and perhaps more variable. But future costs are going to depend mostly on fuel prices. I don't think the administrative costs change much from year to year. And all we did was say we expect fuel costs to remain fairly constant and therefore program costs to remain fairly constant. It is not based so much on usage. I think that program usage, individual, remember this is an individual usage program, and that 500 kilowatt hours per month is not very much. So it's not that usage goes up and down a great deal. It's the amount of the rate that's subsidized, and that's determined by the cost differences between, I guess you could say, hydropower, gas power in Anchorage versus diesel power in rural communities.
We have Mira Kohler online. I know she's been working with the Alaska Village Electric Co-op for some time. Mira, welcome to Senate Finance. I have a question for you.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm available.
Thank you. Mira, is there a cap on kilowatt usage for individual consumers that benefit from power cost equalization, or a floor?
Yes, there is a cap of 500 kilowatt hours in a month. The floor is simply the base rate that everybody has to pay, and right now that rate is about 18 cents a kilowatt hour. And the PCE is calculated by 95% of the value of the difference between the utility's cost of power, of producing that power, and that 18 cents floor. So our typical rate in our villages is around 21 to 22 cents for the first 500 kilowatt hours. And then above that, it's between typically 48 and as high as 73 cents, because in a couple of villages we have to fly in fuel.
Mira, thank you for those comments. I just wanted to get on the record. There was a cap on the kilowatt usage so that those that might be following this discussion, going back to whether people leave the lights on or not, that does not happen. If it does, the state's portion to stabilize energy costs is not included in that additional usage. But the first 500 kilowatts are paid for, and so it does support Mr. Teal in that energy costs of the supply, the base supply for producing the energy, is what will drive that a future total program cost either up or down. So if you look back between FY 13 and FY 17, you'll see costs in the neighborhood of $41 million for that program. And so I just wanted those that are following at home to know that there is a cap of usage on that program, and the variable indeed is the fuel supply. Senator Stevens, you had a question.
Well, not so much a question, Madam Chair, but I have appreciated this overview. It's been great to understand a little bit better. But I don't think we've really addressed the benefits that we have achieved over the last 30 years. When I look at the state-subsidized energy projects, and I don't think really appreciated by the public as much as they should be, the building of the Bradley Lake Dam that affects Homer and all of the Kenai Peninsula, the Kodiak Terror Lake project that it will be there for hundreds of years, and has really made an enormous difference. We are in a different place now, much of Alaska, than we were before this project, power cost equalization, existed. I think it just needs to be recognized that many of us have benefited over the years from these enormous hydroelectric plants, and I see that that others need to benefit in the future. And I thank you very much for that. But I just think we need to sort of pat ourselves on the back, not just my presence here, but all those who have been here before who really saw this through and took a great step forward that has continued to pay benefits for hundreds of years. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Stevens. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're touching right on a subject I wanted to talk about, the program costs. And I think there's a direct correlation between that and allocation to rural energy programs. You and Senator Hoffman both said on that committee that looks at those projects. And I wish if I was had a magic wand and I could put a $50 million a year into those projects, because theoretically those projects are going to lower the cost of energy in those communities around the state. We know where they're at. The projects are identified to lower the energy costs, but we're lacking one thing, and that's cash. But in time, if we ever get there, that should help with lowering the total program cost as more villages become efficient. And Senator Stevens just, I don't think you burn much diesel fuel at all there in Kodiak anymore.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Bishop. They are good projects. They certainly are good projects that put people to work and reduce hydrocarbon emission. Senator Stevens, would you like to point out Kodiak's use of renewable energy? And
well, just thank you, Madam Chair. Just to say that we have now reduced it, the use of fuel to about 1% or 2% only, in order to keep the diesel engines working in an operation. Now we are virtually 99% renewable energy, and we owe it to this program and the state's willingness to move ahead with these projects. I'm not sure how much how can you compare that to Bradley Lake, but I know it's had an enormous difference. The whole interconnectedness of Bradley Lake has been tremendous. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like to put one or more item on the table that affects the cost of power, and that is previous tax credits, and specifically for the urban areas in the Cook Inlet Basin. So tax credits were used to secure energy in the urban, in the rail belt area, with hundreds of millions of dollars of tax credit incentives, and that was that. I know some may not consider that a subsidy, that those were tax credits to secure the supply, but indeed it provided lower cost energy than would have been available if we hadn't done it before. At least that's my perspective. I don't want to speak for the entire finance team, but there was a reason that the legislature, prior to my arrival in the Senate, that those tax credits were issued in the Cook Inlet region. As I recall, when I served on the Anchorage Assembly, we were preparing for brownouts and lack of supply, at least long-term supply, and so legislators prior to my service looked at Cook Inlet and tried to incentivize that basin to provide for energy costs to the rail belt. And so as we debate whether the Power Cost Equalization Fund is a fund available for appropriation or should be protected to benefit all of Alaska, I just want to make sure that the people that I represent understand that all Alaska came together to help subsidize, invest in Cook Inlet to make sure that the rail belt had a sustainable long-term supply of energy. And those numbers do count when I do the math, and so I just want to put that on the record. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and apologize for being late. I had a bill up. When you think about the credits that we're having to deal with now, I mean, almost every area of the state, I'm just sort of dovetailing on your comments, has enjoyed some level of benefit to counter high production, high energy costs around the state. The question I was going to ask is, a lot of PEC or PCE is used to help lower the costs of relatively unsustainable sources of energy like diesel that's brought into various communities. I'm just wondering if the I don't know if this is for Mr. Teal or for Senator Hoffman, but on sort of longer term sustainable possibilities where renewables are not available, could it be used for other energy projects that are arguably more sustainable, like local gas wells and that sort of thing, where appropriate?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that there are communities down in the chain that are looking at the viability of getting off of diesel and looking at hydro, and their numbers don't actually pencil out, but they're very close. So I could see if it's a decision by them with a change in the law that could allow, say, a community to, once, if they were given, say, 5 years worth of power cost equalization, to assist them to get over the bump for a 5-year period, and they would be completely off power cost equalization, which would reduce the demand in the future, is a program that probably should be considered, because without them going forward, they would not make that investment, and they would continue to be dependent upon the power cost equalization subsidy. So I think there is room for changes in the program, the future, that could incentivize borderline projects that can go on long-term renewable energy sources that should be considered by the legislature.
If I might, Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman and I serve on Alaska's Renewable Energy Advisory Board, and AEA has adopted some very unique and specific criteria to look at the costs in any individual community and a return on investment criteria where you have to exceed $1, or a one-for-one ratio. And we have, Senator Hoffman and I, during those debates with the committee, looked at hydrocarbons and whether, when the return on ratio got low, as Senator Hoffman is talking or has just talked about, whether natural gas or propane or other supply might step in instead of going into another renewable energy project. I would also state that we have looked at what has happened in those communities where we've stood up renewable energy projects. And this committee needs to be aware, as all of Alaska, that the air quality environment is impacted in a positive way, but not always the cost of the fuel supply into those communities. And what I mean is when we put in a project, if the state facility, like the school, is the center to that community, it may be the major tenant of an individual utility. And so we haven't seen the cost savings on those projects as we thought we would, because there are fixed costs for all those smaller utilities. We have 100-plus island utilities that have fixed costs that are reaching consumers. And when the state is the anchor tenant and we come in with a renewable energy project, while we've improved the environment and lowered the cost initially through the recovery of the rates that the island utility is having to do, we don't see the consumers seeing a reduction in rate. I hope that makes sense, because it is where we've been, my office has been going around on a merry-go-round, per se, this summer in trying to analyze why those costs didn't go down. And the bottom line is the fixed costs for the utilities that are out there. We have improved conditions, but the overall cost savings are marginal in the end for some of the projects. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think just listening to the conversation, I'm sort of seeing that there's two conversations having here simultaneously. First, the revenue of the fund. The good decisions made by many of the people here in this table over the years has created a billion-dollar fund now. The revenue, some of the sources in the past have been from the general fund and when earnings were good. I don't know if that's a possibility in the future, and I know that Mr. Teal has a slide in here that says if we keep revenue, you know, with an input of $30 million a year or so, then the payouts can be maintained. I don't know if that's the right conversation, if maybe we should pivot. Now that we have $1 billion in the fund, perhaps there should just be a different way that we look at it. That's the revenue side. Then there's conversations with the expense side, and I'm really glad, Senator McKinnon, you brought up the Alaska Energy Authority. I think that is the program that is useful to help evaluate the rural systems that are ripe and ready to go for investment. There are green banks available down in the lower 48 that are looking to help pair investments, maybe less than 50%, but with other AEA monies, we can actually do some viable projects. So there's two conversations. There's both revenue and expenses. I'm all for predictability, sustainability. Volatility gives me heartburn, and that's just sort of how I'm looking at it right now.
Thank you for those comments. Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think what Senator Von Imhoff is getting at is that right now, both PC, the spin-off, the excess earnings or earnings beyond program costs, are determined by the earnings, which are volatile, and that we could stabilize the amount available for community assistance by going to an endowment model rather than an earnings model. So this slide has a more typical payout from an endowment. All I did was change the earnings rate to 5%, but it's not an earnings rate anymore, it's a payout rate. And then it wouldn't be 70% of the excess, because the 70% there was really an inflation proofer. So you'd be looking at, if you paid 5% percent of market value out, that there would be, 16, 17, up to $20 million per year on a very stable basis available for community assistance. So that you would get away from the, well, this year you need $30 million in general funds and next year you need nothing because earnings are volatile. Going to an endowment model could make it so that your general fund needs are far more stable, in the neighborhood of $10 to $15 million per year.
Thank you, Mr. Teal.
The endowment's probably large enough now to consider making that switch.
Other questions on power cost equalization and how community assistance is being funded in part? This year is a unique year because of high earnings in FY17. And so, as has been discussed at this table, there will be volatility, but it appears that we will have some money rolling off from power cost equalization in future years to help reduce the general fund payment or to maintain this program. And that was the goal when we put those bills forward. Senator Machicki.
I was curious, looking at the table, what was the average earnings from 04 through 17?
10%, but that's just a guess, looking at the numbers.
Somehow didn't get that. 9%, Madam Chair.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Mr. Teal.
Madam Chair, the average earnings from 04 through 17 were roughly 9%.
Thank you. Ms. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just pointing out the obvious that an endowment model of 5%, just as we've talked about in other pieces of legislation in the building, is proven to be an adequately conservative model. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions on power cost equalization? Small communities and individuals that reside in those communities benefit from the 500 kilowatt hours. I would put on the record that we did have a senator at this table that expressed situations where there are people in Alaska that don't benefit from the individual subsidies, either from power cost equalization or from the tax credits that we put in Cook Inlet, that there are people in more rural parts of Mat-Su or even Mat-Su that believe that they do not benefit from the investments that the state has made in other energy sources, that they're off the grid, per se. If they're on the grid, they're benefiting in some way from either the feedstock that's coming into the system being reduced in price or power cost equalization, but a former senator of this body did say that there are parts of Mat-Su that are off the grid that aren't currently benefiting from power cost equalization or the investment in Cook Inlet. So I just wanted to put that on the record that there are communities that don't see some of those savings. Any other questions from committee members? Senator Machicki?
Well, Madam Chair, that could be a long discussion for us to describe the value to anyone in South Central that is paying property taxes. The costs of municipal buildings and schools and state buildings has been reduced dramatically because of natural gas energy, and they benefit from that directly on trying to cover those costs and their property taxes. So whether you're directly connected to the grid or you live in a community that benefits, there's a direct correlation to, and I'm not defending the credit amount because, you know, I wasn't a big fan of that bill, but the reality of it is everyone benefits if they're a part of that community.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. I know everyone around this table understands that there are many perspectives on any policy decisions that this body undertakes, and we've had several good discussions today, one about power cost equalization, about the size of the power cost equalization fund, about community assistance and its importance to individual communities, about the stability of the revenue assistance that's going into those communities, as well as projects that are important to all communities throughout our state. Is there anything else to put on the record for the people of Alaska in looking at and understanding the complexity on the interaction, at least of this, of the Power Cost Equalization Fund and the community assistance that is now provided. Mr. Teel, any closing comments for consideration of the committee on this issue?
No, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman?
Well, I think that energy costs continue to be an issue throughout the state of Alaska, and I would like to thank this committee and past legislators for working on energy and energy costs. It is still a big issue to all Alaskans, because even though we are a major provider, not as much today as in the past, for providing energy to other states, we still have some of the highest costs of energy in Alaska. And I know people at this table are interested in trying to address that, and I think that is why we continue to look at trying to get a natural gas line in the state of Alaska. And we all know that we will benefit substantially by lower energy costs because of the legislation that passed this body with support to address that issue. So I would just like to go on record to thank people in urban Alaska for recognizing and assisting people in rural Alaska to try to get a control over their costs. I know 500 kilowatts does not sound like much, but it does have a substantial impact upon people living in rural areas, and I'll tell you that they try to control their consumption of electricity, because after that 500 kilowatt hour, they have to pay full boat. And I remember when we were dealing with this program, we had one community that was very, very high, and that was Lime Village, where they were paying $1.07 a kilowatt. So once they got over 500 kilowatts, the subsidy was gone. And who in this room would say that there is a need to address costs of electric energy when you're paying $1.07 a kilowatt? It's astounding. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to echo what Senator Hoffman just said. As a rural legislator, I want to thank the former legislators for setting up the project, especially my predecessor, Senator Adams, who looked at that. Because I think what happens if you don't have affordable energy anywhere in the state of Alaska, you're going to find some place that isn't. You're going to move. And that's where the rural population is most at risk, is that if you have high energy costs and you can't afford it, especially if you're unemployed, living off subsistence, there's that tendency for urban migration. And when you have an unemployed person that doesn't have a skill set that he can become employed as, he contributes, I think, to the, there's a tendency to contribute to the social ills that go on within urban areas. So you increase the homelessness, a polarization of the haves and the have-nots, and that's what I see that this power cost equalization, as well as community assistance, helps to go ahead and stabilize.
Thank you, Senator Olson. As an urban legislator, I just wanted to thank Senator Hoffman specifically, because the urban cities now receive a direct benefit from the accumulation of those funds, which is why we tied it together. Senator Hoffman and I heard concerns about 3 years ago that smaller communities were receiving benefit that larger communities weren't. And so by the roll-off, by the second bucket of community assistance, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kenai, Soldotna, Kodiak are all receiving a benefit from the Power Cost Equalization Fund. Now, as it's been able to roll off and provide that 500 kilowatt investment in the smaller communities, now all of the larger communities are also benefiting to try to help with their costs as they move. So it was a group effort from this committee. Those were not McKinnon and Hoffman bills. They were Senate Finance Committee bills that we carried on behalf of this this committee. And so I just want to thank all those, as the previous speakers, legislators that had the foresight to save that money so that it could benefit all Alaskans at this point in our history. With that, on tomorrow's agenda, we have HB 114, boiler pressure vessel inspections. If we can have any other bills previously heard by this committee prepared, we will try to bring those forward. But as far as I know, for tomorrow, we have HB 114, boiler pressure for introduction. With that, we're adjourned.